Karen Lewis, glad to have you with us. And looking at your book, the memoir by Karen Lewis, I Married a Munster, My Life with Grandpa Al Lewis. Great. It's a very interesting story. Start with the prologue for people that want to know what this is about. It says, my life with Al Lewis was born in a Bronx blizzard, and it died in another fierce blizzard, which brought New York City to its knees, snowbound and silent. Whiteout conditions canceled the funeral. Otherwise, it would have meant an Arctic expedition for even the hardiest of the grief-stricken. And then you said that you thought that Al actually did that because he hated funerals. So tell us a little bit about your life with Grandpa Al Lewis.
Yes, thanks a lot for that, Don. Yeah, this story takes place in about a 30-year span. And the way I wrote it, it starts with the end, and then I jump forward to when it started. And strangely enough, what Don just read is accurate. The very first day I met Al, I was going to rehearsal in the Manhattan Theater Club, and it was snowing and freezing, and the airports were down, and the poor director, oh, I forgot to tell you that I was meeting him there because we were cast in a play together. And it was so cold and frozen that it was one of those days that you never forget. It was in the papers. There are pictures of it to this day. February 22nd, 1979. So I start with that day, and then the week that Al died was also banked in snow, and his funeral had to be canceled. So that's kind of, those are the bookends for my story.
And yeah, go ahead.
And I start when I met him. We were both cast in this play, a Neil Simon play, California Suite. And little did I know that this actor, who was very funny and kind of brusque and rude and hilarious, would become my husband.
I saw the part. I saw the part where when you were first doing this play. I guess it went on tour, right? Because I saw the part where you were in North Carolina, I think. So.
Yeah, we did it in two theaters in North Carolina. It was Dinner Theater.
Mm. So and
in the 70s, that was very, very popular.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's, they of course hired Al as the star, and then they went to New York and they got the other actors that would join him.
And it seems like there was kind of like a rivalry with the people who were, you know, basically Dinner Theater actors, and with of course the star, that they had like kind of a star relationship or perspective on everything he did, that he was, you know, hamming it up. And of course the way Al was, he did things the way he wanted to do them, and that probably fed that a little bit.
And that's right. In that period in the theater, if you're interested in theater history,
sure. Yeah.
There was an emergence of this ensemble idea, and it was going all around the country. People were forming these ensemble theater companies. So Dinner Theater traditionally was a little bit different. It was, you know, broad entertainment for people who'd go out for the evening and have dinner and drink and watch a play.
Mm-hmm.
But this director and the company were cottoned on to this idea that it should be an ensemble play. And Al was having no part of it. He said he was there to entertain the folks who had watched him for all these years, and that's what he was going to do. And he wasn't going to change his performance at all. And there was a huge divide in the company. That was actually so memorable because it showed me in that snapshot, if you will, what kind of a man Al was and what he would not back off from. He believed in what he was doing. He had done it many times before, and he wasn't going to let anybody derail him. And that's the way he was when he was on the air. That's the way he was when he was demonstrating. That's the way he was when he ran for governor.
That's right.
He did not back down.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, he came out of vaudeville originally, right? So he had that whole
Actually, right before that, he was like an apprentice in Yiddish theater.
Right, which is
and again, that style was very bold, and you know, and then the stars would demand their way on stage, and then he was in vaudeville, and then he went on to do all kinds of theater in New York City. Mm. His brother also formed a theater company, the National Theater Company, and Al helped him a lot in terms of backstage stuff and building theaters and putting seats in, you know, those Lower East Side rooms where people had theaters.
Right.
They did that all over New York, too.
I wonder sometimes sitting in a theater, one of those smaller theaters, if Al put the seats in or helped install the carpet
Somebody
or whatever.
Did.
Yep. And then he, while this tension goes on within the cast, and you were sort of on the fence, like sort of whatever you saw, you kind of were going with the wind and studying it, and then you ended up seeing him work the crowd, and everybody said, oh.
Oh, yes. Backstage, it was just a flutter. People just resonated with his energy, and in the audience, the people were just clapping and clapping and doing, you know, encore after encore. And the rest of the people who wanted to have the ensemble, they were complaining and saying that those were cheap laughs. So it was a huge divide in the company.
Cheap laughs put the behinds in the seats that pay for your theater.
Yeah.
There's also, of course, Al's activism, not just as a radio host at WBAI, but going back many years with union workers and, you know, leftist politics, the socialist, communist politics, and that went all the way through his political campaign for governor in 2002 to 1998, I don't remember which. What year was that?
When he ran for governor was 1998.
98, right. Okay, so, and that got the Green Party ballot status in New York. You had to get 50,000 votes,
that's
and
correct.
He got it.
That was the first time. Mm-hmm.
And that was tough, too. They made it sometimes, they didn't make it sometimes in the years subsequent, but he got them on the ballot and got them out in front. There were people that were not pleased with him doing that, weren't there?
Yes, there certainly weren't. The smaller parties were upset because they thought that he was going to take votes from them, and at the same time, the bigger people were also worried about it. We worked extremely hard to sort of bring left and right together. Al did a lot of campaigning way up north in the state, into the west, where people were a little bit more conservative, trying to bring them into the fold. And it's very interesting now when you see what Bernie Sanders is doing and what the Pope is trying to do.
Right.
This is almost 18 years later. And they're basically on Al's platform, the Green Party platform from 1998.
Right.
We call them progressive.
Yeah.
And in terms of what the Green Party was trying to do 17 or 18 years ago, it's nothing. It's the same questions, the same problems, the same platform, basically. So we were working very, very hard during that period. The Green Party was amazing. But it was because Al was willing to really go out and talk to people face to face. We went all over the place together. And we actually learned so much, because when we go into these places upstate, we would see that the prisons were up there because they had no economy anymore. So they had begged the state to have prisons in their area. We did. We went to factories that were being closed up near Syracuse. It was a huge education for me, and I really saw what it took to run a political campaign. It was extremely difficult, not just in terms of keeping the pace, but actually physically, it's very, very hard to go from one town to the next, and especially the Green Party had no money, so we were doing it all on the basis of people helping us, volunteering, taking us in their cars, driving us places, putting us up, feeding us.
Right.
We were all over the place. And still, Al managed, because of his popularity and his, what is it? It's like people recognize his humanity. Mm. They recognized his humanity and wanted to be close to that humor and basic decency. They just loved him. And so people voted for him who'd given up voting. They just thought it was a farce to vote, but they voted for him. And of course, the other parties recognized that power and were afraid of him.
Mm. Yeah, as far as that trying to join left and right together, for example, among the groups of workers that he worked with and for and advocated for were police unions, the PBA. He pointed out to them at every opportunity that, and to everyone else, that these are workers too. They stand
That's
in
right,
relation
kid.
To this thing in the same way that you do. They're just doing an uglier job that they need to be convinced to do differently or on a different side.
That's right. So he always said something on the, when he was at WBAI on the air. He always took side with the police if he could. You remember that was the Giuliani period.
Right.
And then David Dinkins, and there were lots of problems with the police department.
Mm-hmm.
And he would stand up for them.
They were solid
working people. They had families to take care of, and we had to remember that.
Yeah, he wouldn't stand with them against the community. He would stand with them against, say, Giuliani or Dinkins or the administration in the way that you would with workers.
That's correct.
He had quite a precise analysis of things, I think, just from watching his behavior from the outside and from listening to... I listened to the show you guys did often, and I always felt like I made contact with somebody listening to it. And like, oh yeah, I'm not crazy. That is how things are. Somebody else sees it too. And in addition to that, learned history, because he would talk about things that happened in the 1930s and the 1940s and the 1950s that were counter to the narrative that we get out of our history books.
Yes, that's what he did. Actually, you couldn't tell on the air, but he would spend most of the week organizing his thoughts around his past and what it meant to the news and what he could bring from his past to what was happening in the present. There's one story that I wanted to tell you about the police before we move on, and that's it's a very small chapter in the book. We were in Flushing, Queens, at a funeral, and it was very hot and it was very sad, so we decided to walk down Main Street and see if we could find a place to eat. We pulled up next to a restaurant on the sidewalk, and we're looking at the menu, you know how they have them in the window. And as we were standing there, this car screeched down the opposite side of the street, went over the median and up on the sidewalk where we were standing, and our hearts were in our mouths. And out jumped four guys, and they started running towards Al and said, "Schnauzer, hello, hello, Schnauzer." Here it was, four undercover cops in funny costumes, and they yelled, "We just came off of a bust, a drug bust. We're so happy to see you." And they started singing Car 54, "Where Are You?"
That's
it was
right.
Just amazing. But it was because he took, the police so seriously that they loved him.
And
they showed it that afternoon.
The other night, I'm spending time at my parents' house. My father passed last month, and I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning or so. The TV was on. Car 54, Where Are You? Was on. It was the episode where Fred Gwynn runs again as the head of the police union.
Yeah. They're very funny.
Mm.
Well, I was working with tenants, so I really liked the Car 54 episode where they're trying to evict Molly Picon from her little apartment because they want to build a bigger building. And I think in that one, Al plays the housing commissioner. He just ends up giving up. She keeps her apartment at the end. It's just hilarious.
Yeah, knowing his politics from, hearing the show and with the Green Party and other stuff that I learned subsequent to when Car 54, Where Are You? Was on when I was like 5 years old, looking at that again through that lens, it gives it a really interesting perspective to see how they treated these issues in that program and how he related to it. Because it was not, it wasn't an accommodation or betrayal the way he did it.
No, Al really praised Nat Hike and the writer of that particular sitcom for those reasons. He felt that he was really on the money and really with the people. It's ordinary people in New York City and what they were confronting.
And that, you know, is in barely the aftermath of the McCarthy era, where they purged everyone who was an even practically a social Democrat from everything.
Yes, that's right.
So, what do you think is, maybe give us one or a couple of the more humorous anecdotes in the book to give people a tease. Don't give away the store, but give them a tease.
Well, I thought that one was pretty humorous, too. Mm-hmm. And it, all the way through the book, what I'm trying to do is to show our relationship and what it was doing for me. So it's also a very powerful women's story.
Ooh,
there are lots of hilarious anecdotes in it.
Very serious part of the women's story. The relationship that you and Al's first wife had, and particularly the way the scenario that you describe at the time that she passed. You were very close,
yes,
weren't you?
Very early on, Al told me this story. This is not humorous, unfortunately, about being called from the Munsters set because his wife, who was vacationing with her twin in Florida, had been in a terrible car accident. And all three of Al's children were there with her. So he went to the hospital and found, you know, his family in bandages, and it was very, very moving. He thought he had lost his family in that one moment of a car crash. And it was actually a drunk driver who had hit them. So I really got a very bold picture from that anecdote of what marriage can mean when you're, you know, you're really committed to somebody and you don't really know what will happen. And one of the things that I wrote this book for was for young women. When I was coming up, I had about as much training about how to pick a partner as I did a car, probably better with the car.
Mm-hmm.
And Al was teaching me through our lives how to live a more purposeful life. And has a lot to do with choices and commitments. And being true to yourself. That was one of his big cries. Be true to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Believe in yourself. And that's what I want to show the reader who goes through the whole story. That this book is a little bit difficult because the through line is, of course, about marriage and about being a responsive and responsible partner to someone. But all through it is woven these other themes. So if you start to pull them apart, the story kind of comes apart. It's all of these things at once. It's a kind of an accumulative experience. So you're right. If I pull one of these stories out, that may not be what the book is about, but it's a part of the book. So yes, we had these hilarious moments with police officers in Flushing, Queens, when they sang Car 54, Where Are You, to us. We had another car incident where our car broke down, and a family came up and saved us. They actually put us in their car and drove us to safety. Hmm. These things happen to us frequently, and they're very, Al took them very tenderly and caringly, not expecting them to happen, but so appreciative when people did respond to him that way. And I was the beneficiary of that. That was part of his fame that he handled extremely well. Another theme of this book is fame. And when I started out in the theater, it was just something we all wanted, but we really didn't know what it was that we wanted.
Right.
And what we'd be in for if we got it. And Al showed me a very special way of handling it. Of course, he was a comedic actor, and he would say, well, you know, some of these leading men who are considered, you know, love objects had a much more difficult time with it. Fame is a very thorny, thorny goal, very thorny business. And I tried to touch on that as much as I could in the book.
Looking at the cover and the notes from the various people, little blurbs, you have one from Pat Priest, who was Marilyn on the Munsters. She was the ugly one, quote unquote.
Exactly.
She was a knockout blonde who was ugly. The entire idea was about the relative nature of beauty, the subjective nature of it. And it was like just an ironic joke in the middle of the program. They were close, I guess, up until Al's passing, and even from Howard Stern, his blurb is a comedian commenting on another comedian. He said, "You know, marrying a monster had to be a roller coaster ride," referring to the book. "Whenever I was with Grandpa Al, it was an unpredictable journey with a masterful and brilliant actor. Even if you don't love the Munsters, didn't love the Munsters, buy this book." And then he says, "I'm sure that fabulous Karen Lewis could use the money."
That's his joke, all right. Just like him.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That is a Howard Sternism, I think, yes. So I guess Al knew a lot of people, and across the spectrum, I mean, Howard Stern is not exactly what you would call a leftist, for example, and yet they had a fabulous personal relationship, right?
That's correct. Al would say, you know, I want to have some fun. I want to play. And he took it at face value.
And, for example, Howard Stern would be friendly with George Pataki on the air, and Al would call him Potato Head Pataki.
That's right.
I guess we got to close this. If you wanted to summarize your life with Grandpa Al Lewis in two or three sentences, how would you do that?
Oh, my goodness. That's really a challenge. I would say that, like Howard, it was a roller coaster ride, up and down. I would say, oh, my goodness, that it was like living with a force of nature, that I had a wonderful, wonderful marriage to this man. And that I wish that everybody in the world could have a relationship to someone just like Al.
And if they want to know any more than that, the book, I Married a Munster, My Life with Grandpa Al Lewis, a memoir by Karen Lewis. And you got to buy the book. Is there a website where people can find this?
It's under construction. I'm really sorry about that. They can go online to any of the big booksellers. And they'll find lots of stuff about the book there.
And there's lots of photographs of Al at various points in his life, and you guys at various points in your life together. And those alone are worth the price of admission. Karen Lewis.
Yes, there are 47 images in this book. That's a lot.
Thank you. Karen Lewis, thank you very much. Pleasure.
Thank you, Don. Nice talking to you. Thank you for this opportunity.
And thank you.